From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Guerlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. John Harris specializes in sustainable urbanization with a focus on Africa. His work examines what community members want on a day-to-day basis.
Do our typical concepts of the city, do they fall short if we're not really better understanding the way that people are living?
And I'll talk with Rebecca Cruz about the effects of the Trump administration's executive order of a week ago that bans entry to the United States for immigrants and refugees from 7 predominantly Muslim countries.
How this plays through the world matters. It will continue to affect us even if this is entirely rescinded.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlot. Rebecca Cruz, there's obviously an issue that's been weighing heavily on all of us this week, an international issue that everyone, I'm sure, is quite aware is going on. A week ago, the executive order regarding immigration and the travel ban, the immigrant ban on 7 countries, predominantly Muslim countries in the Middle East. And the impact of that, I guess, obviously for us here at the university on students, the impact on millions of students around the country, but also just millions and millions of people, human beings that are being affected by this. We've seen things kind of evolve and change. Things are very fluid in terms of, the travel ban being implemented immediately. And then so people in the air and people arriving at airports that had valid visas were turned away. And there have been a number of court cases, a court case that then actually let people leave the airport. Their visas were honored. And now it seems to be that the immigrant part of the executive order, those with green cards or permanent residency, will be allowed to enter and to travel. So it refers to the non-immigrant, meaning student visas, work visas, other types of visa categories, medical visas, all sorts of things.
Refugees.
Refugees, of course, that's where this ultimately started, are still on the list and affected in terms of if they're in the country, if they leave, they won't be able to get back in. If they had a valid visa and are outside the country, are not be able to re-enter. So here we are a few days later. And so what are some of your thoughts? What are we seeing happening now? What can we expect?
Well, I think a lot has been said about kind of the domestic response to this. And so I wanted to focus a little bit on the international response. It's been almost entirely negative. Even some of our closest allies have come out and condemned this action, certainly the implementation of this action. As you said, a lot of confusion on how this was implemented. There was, for a time, dual nationals that were being prevented from coming in, which caused a great deal of problem. But Germany, for example, has been very vocal about this. Angela Merkel came out and explained that on both moral and legal grounds, our refusal of allowing refugees in is problematic, that we are the so-called leader of the free world. We should do better on moral grounds, human rights grounds, but also that we have made a declaration to take care of refugees, to take them in. And that is something that we had committed to decades ago and should continue to uphold. Other leaders around the world have also voiced their concern. An interesting case is Theresa May, who we seem to be talking about a lot lately. She was just in the United States, the first state visit, and left right before the executive order was put out. She got a lot of criticism for not condemning Trump. She backtracked slightly and said that this was not their type of policy and they would not be implementing something similar, but has gotten a lot of pushback from her constituents. There has been a petition that nearly 2 million people have signed asking that the invite for President Trump to come and meet with the Queen here in a couple months, that it be taken back. So almost 2 million people. There is a counter petition with a couple 100,000 saying that he should still come and be accepted. She's refuted this, said the invite is going to stand and that he will come. But some interesting reactions. There are also interesting reactions in the tech industry, obviously very much affected by some of this. Almost all of the Fortune 100 companies have come out and said that they are watching this, that they are concerned, that they are worried. And some have come out and made some very stark pledges. Apple, for example, pointed out, of course, that their founder was the son of a Syrian refugee. And Google has come out and said that they are going to raise $4 million for the ACLU. So a lot of activity there, a lot of reaction around the world.
You've touched on so many things. I mean, obviously, the way in which people are responding by donating money to those organizations that are helping fight the legal battle on this. There does seem to be, you focused on the international reaction. It doesn't seem to be mixed at all internationally. There doesn't seem to be anyone that's come out in support of it. And in fact, Australia was on the phone with the administration earlier this week, and we have an agreement to take an agreement in place to take a little over 1,000 refugees that are currently in Australia into our country, and that seems to be on ice for now. But there's obviously, as we've seen, mixed reaction in the U.S. Right, we're almost split on this issue, and nobody really seems to know, you know, where we're headed on this. But we can't spend time on an international show without recognizing this very important connection between this domestic issue and the international reaction.
Absolutely. And how this plays to the world matters. It will continue to affect us even if this is entirely rescinded.
It's certainly setting the stage. All right. Thank you, Rebecca, so much for being here.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org, or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzette Corlett. Next, I'll talk with John Harris. He's an urban and regional planner in the University of Oklahoma's College of Architecture. He works on sustainability projects for rapidly growing cities in Africa. I'm Suzette Corlett, and this is Worldviews. John Harris teaches urban and regional planning in the University of Oklahoma's College of Architecture. His focus is on sustainable urban development in the developing world and how to help residents of so-called informal cities make their own decisions about planning their communities. John Harris, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really interested in your work. You're in the College of Architecture, but your area of emphasis is urban and regional planning. Can we just start out by talking about what that is, exactly what you do, and how that fits into the whole kind of architecture field? I mean, obviously, you're designing cities or studying the design of cities and how to best design cities. Can you just give us a little background there?
Sure. Urban planners, we're concerned really with many aspects of human settlements, and a lot of that is how we regulate the built environment. So we work with designers to figure out the best way to meet needs of different societies. But we're also looking, even from a, you know, maybe more of a 30,000 feet level perspective, looking at how are cities meeting the needs of their populations, whether that's economically, culturally, all the different needs that people have for where they live.
Well, it obviously sounds very interdisciplinary then, if you're looking at economic issues and societal needs and relationships and that sort of thing. So I assume you're incorporating a lot of other ideas and experiences into your work.
So here at OU, we are in the College of Architecture. There are other planning programs that are in public policy programs that are attached to geography departments, that sort of thing. So we are at our best when we are connected to other disciplines. That's the truth.
So I noticed in part of your work that you focused on sustainable urbanization. I assume that's not just the environment here and kind of protecting the environment. Obviously, urbanization has an impact on one's environment and resources. But is it more than that? Are there other things we need to be concerned about sustaining in an urban environment?
I think demographically, humanity as a species became an urban species sometime in 2008. You know, we moved from being a majority rural population to a majority urban, and while we have been, you know, urbanizing for centuries, that raises new challenges for us. It, not only sort of like you said with the environment, but how do we meet our needs within cities for energy, for food, for really what we want to be as humans individually. And I think when we think about sustainability, you know, everybody says it, but what do we ever mean by it? I think that the reality is that that's a concept that's ever expanding. But at the same time, we've got to pin it down and really in the everyday experience of people. And so I think within my discipline, we are looking at how do concepts of sustainability within your neighborhood, within your block, within the people that you relate to on a day-to-day level, how is that meaningful? And how can we, within these contexts, push ourselves towards more sustainable solutions?
So I'm just thinking, first of all, something you said just kind of blew my mind, that we've officially become an urban planet, I guess, mm-hmm. since 2008. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that kind of shocks me a little bit, that we officially became more urban than rural only 8 years ago. I mean, why is it that that's surprising to me?
Well, you know, it's and a lot of that has to do so with places in East Asia, places in South Asia and in Africa, which are rapidly urbanizing. And so, you know, Europe, North America, we've been largely urban for quite some time. And it's some of the other continents that really are driving that at this time.
Very interesting. Well, back to this concept of sustainability, it sounds to me like maybe what you're referring to is a sense of just kind of having reliable access to things every day. Okay, so so reliability and being able to make a living and being able to you know, have to turn on the tap or have access, you know, regular access to water, reliable services and you know, things that we need to sustain life every day. I guess mm-hmm. that's kind of maybe is that an accurate way of portraying it?
If that's not part of your concept of sustainability, then it's really sort of divorced from the reality of people's lives. And I think that's, we get into a problem when our concepts like sustainability or economic development or anything that really drives policy both at the local level and at the international level, if we're divorcing that from people's everyday lives, the things that they want for themselves, the things that they want day to day, I think we're in trouble.
That's John Harris. He's an urban and regional planning professor at the University of Oklahoma. After the break, we'll talk about his work in the African country of Zambia. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest is John Harris, who specializes in sustainable urban development. Just before the break, we were talking about informal cities. Well, so let's talk a little bit about your work in Africa. Mm-hmm. You've spent a lot of time in the continent in multiple countries, some work in Kenya on tourism and how that contributes to economic development, I believe, and work in Zambia as well on informal settlements. Can you give us an idea of what you mean by informal life and informal settlements and informal cities and how that all plays into this kind of urban and regional planning issue?
Sure. The concept of informality, and it's difficult to pin down. It's one of those concepts that is squishy. We began thinking about informality really in the 70s, thinking about informal economics. We looked at African cities and looked at the way that people, you know, made a living and they were working jobs or in industries or you know, selling things on the street that's not regulated, it's not taxed, it's not officially recognized. And so because it's not officially recognized, we began to call it informal. But then we started to think, you know what, that label, so to speak, describes a lot of other aspects of urbanization in these contexts. So we began talking about informal housing. So where people are, you know, living on land that who owns it is really not an easy question to answer. They are building their own structures that aren't regulated by any building code, anything like that. And so we began to call that informal. But the catch here is that, of course, we have that in the United States, right? Somebody will, you know, convert a garage into an apartment and not have it permitted. But in most African cities, we're talking between 60% and 80% of the population lives in informal housing, goes to work every day to feed their family in an informal job, accesses electricity or water in ways that can best be described as informal or extra legal. And so now we're looking at that as, you know, is that a different way of building cities? Is that a different way of building a civilization than we have seen? And do our typical concepts of the city, do they fall short if we're not really better understanding the way that people are living in these ways?
Is it that people are having to, you know, build these kind of informal structures or build these informal cities and informal lives because the government is unable to regulate that stuff, or because, you know, you have to skirt the law? Are there laws that apply? I mean, I know we're being very careful about not using the term illegal. You used extra legal. Obviously, informality would indicate that these things aren't being regulated. So what is the relationship here between these kinds of things and governments? And I imagine that might vary from place to place as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. A lot of these places, we mentioned urbanization, and the reality is that urbanization, the pace of urbanization, far outpaced the ability of governments to respond. So even in the best cases, governments that were very proactive in some Asian cities and African cities and some Latin American cities, that just could not keep up with the amount of people that were coming to their cities. I mean, something that we don't remember is that was true even in America's urban history, right? I mean, you think of the photography of Jacob Riis, who, you know, with How the Other Half Lives, he was able to capture urban United States, which really does resemble some of the conditions we see other places in the world today, although that was 100, 150 years ago in New York. So it's about the pace of urbanization, but also it's about the political choices that governments are making. You know, in a lot of African cities, they were designed on an apartheid structure. Many African cities until relatively recent, before independence for many of these countries, white settlers and black Africans were not allowed on the same parts of the city. And if you look at those cities, whether you're talking about Nairobi or Lusaka or places like that, that structure still dominates the urban form. And so you see a place like Lusaka, the governments would not officially recognize that black Africans were moving to the city. And so they had to find a place to live. And those areas now are the informal settlements. And so that has these deep roots in colonization and that sort of thing.
So I would imagine that as governments develop, as there's some sort of political development in many of these countries, for the case of Brazil, for example, that then trying to formalize some of this informal structure becomes also very tricky. And but yet there's a demand to do so in order to, you know, provide services like water, for example, or electricity and trash collection. I mean, there are things that obviously these informal settlements and cities need. And so there then becomes some difficult, you know, exchanges and negotiations trying to formalize what has been developed as in an informal way.
Yeah, and you've asked the right question here. We often use the term upgrading. We call it either urban upgrading or slum upgrading. And if you look at the new Sustainable Development Goals, one of the goals is to, quote unquote, upgrade all of the world's slums. And slum is a very deliberate word in this case, and this is usually referring to informal settlements. And so over the next decades, the international community is intended to invest mass amounts of our resources to do that very thing, to formalize what is currently informal. And so in a typical upgrading scheme, you're talking about running roads through settlements that really only have footpaths. You're talking about running drainage ditches through, formalizing the water system, right? All the things you're talking about, which is very difficult, right? You're talking about displacing people, but also what are the sort of democratic institutions that will be brought to bear on these decisions? And actually that informs some of the work that I've been doing. At OU, actually with OU students, we've been in Lusaka trying to learn from vulnerable youth about their priorities for these types of upgrades. So we did what's called Photo Voice, where we had vulnerable urban youth that live in these informal settlements in Lusaka. They were out in their neighborhoods taking pictures of their settlements, both the things that they really appreciate, the things that they like in these informal settlements, but also the things that are really quite challenging to them on a day-to-day level. Going back to that idea idea that all of these big ideas need to be connected to what people really want from life. And so right now we are processing that data and have a few publications out under review trying to show that, you know, the way that these young people, these vulnerable young people, see their neighborhoods and the priorities that they have for their lives are a little bit different than sort of the typical, well, here's what we're going to do to upgrade these settlements. So it's a very tricky circumstance. But at the same time, I think it's very hopeful that the international community has said, you know what, we're going to make these a priorities. We're going to put this in writing. We're going to sign our name on the line. And this is what we're going to do over the next decades.
Well, the work you're doing with youth sounds really fascinating and also brings to mind the fact that that the work you're doing is even more interdisciplinary when you get into things like, young or early childhood education and health and well-being, that this is even a broader issue and has so many implications. What are some of the bright spots? Where can we look to kind of see where this type of urbanization or these informal cities that have created this maybe unplanned urbanization as being kind of the shining examples, if you will, of how, you know, these things can grow and mature and become more sustainable for those who live there?
There are a couple of organizations, and I mentioned sort of the democratic institutions of how we do these types of upgrading schemes. There are organizations like, they call themselves Slum/Slack Dwellers International, or Federations of the Urban Poor. There are a number of organizations that do this, and what they are doing is getting into these communities and organizing the residents in some ways similar but in a much better way than what we are doing. They're organizing communities of the urban poor in these informal settlements to say, you know what, here's what we would like. Here are the solutions that we think would improve quality of life here that would allow us to contribute to the wider economy in more prosperous ways. And I think that they're really bright, shining spots in all these big issues.
Wonderful, John. Thank you so much for being here today to teach us about something that we rarely think about. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with John Harris. He teaches urban and regional planning at the University of Oklahoma. You can find more information online at kgou.org and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is part of a partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Sam Dupre produced the show, and Jacob McClellan edited this interview. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Guerlotte.